If we're thinking about implications today for the Williams argument that in some respects Britain was shaped by the period of colonial slavery and the labour of enslaved Africans, then one way to begin to think about it is to look at individual institutions that survive today that were active in that period. And of course, many, many firms today didn't exist, in some cases now because of the technological rate of change, they didn't exist 20 years ago, 10 years ago. But some do. And particularly, if you like, the pipe work of the British economy in finance tends to have long continuities. And RBS, Royal Bank of Scotland, which we still all own, less than we used to, but we owned it, is an amalgamation of banks over many years. And some time ago, in the late 1990s, it took over a bank called NatWest, National Westminster Bank in Britain, in England. NatWest had been formed itself from the consolidation over 150 years of hundreds of component banks. And this report is not a voluntary report. No company, to my mind, would do this unless they had to. And it arose because in Chicago there was an obligation, if you wanted to do business with the city in Chicago, you had to provide an affidavit which said, amongst other things, we haven't bribed any of your councilmen recently, we're not members of an organized crime group, and we have researched our historical past, and we have no connections with slavery. And so RBS commissioned this research in that context. The bank I used to work for, JP Morgan, signed the form and sent it back in, saying we have no connection with slavery. And one of the council women there said, that can't be right. That can't be right. You were active as a bank pre-Civil War. Go back and do the work. And JP Morgan did it, didn't. The same kind of work. It hired historical consultants, did the work and found, of course, that predecessor firms had been active in mortgaging enslaved people in Louisiana. And Morgan then set up a foundation in Louisiana, $5 million for African-American students, scholarships, and tried to move on from that. This was in 2005. The piece of work done here by RBS is, to me, very interesting. RBS, obviously, is a British bank. It's in the US regulatory system. Part of the report deals with its American subsidiary, Citizens Financial, but part of it then deals with the British history. And you'll see how carefully packaged it is to express what the bank wanted to express in this and to control and manage down this research. We looked at this at an early stage of the RBS project and said, this cannot be right. This cannot be right. You have 50 or 60 banks who came together, which are listed in an appendix, and we know, we can tell you right now, that some of those banks appear in the compensation records. Mm. And they said, yeah, that looks right to us. And so, and you can find this online still, there's a version, you've got the original 2006, rare and precious, but now the online version is 2009. It's been re-edited, or it's been edited to add in the stuff that we'd said to them, you just can't leave this out. Right? You don't have to work very hard, all you have to do is do the work that you've said you've done. And so they've added a series of incidents. The packaging remains effectively the same, but they've added data to it. And so that process, if you put the report together, this original and the new one, then you can see the accretion. There's nothing in this report here that suggests that it's preliminary, provisional, incomplete. Something we did in our whole days. In 2006, it's here it is. We've done the work. This is the truth. Now, of course, all history, of course, is revised as new information becomes clearer. Of course it is. But here, I have to say, the early additions they made were ones that really, really should have been in the original report. Sir John Gladstone was a director of RBS. You have to know about Gladstone. Even at that time, it wasn't a secret. Now it's even more widely known. But that process of revising even the corporate history is an interesting one. And there is, of course, a last piece of work to do, and maybe some of your students will do it, which is to look at individual banks who are listed in there, but not listed as subsidiary components, but not singled out as having been involved in slavery, and for them to do the work just to demonstrate, relatively straightforwardly, that banks were involved in slavery. Because if you were a bank in a port town, a port city, in the 18th and 19th century, you were going to be connected to the slavery business in some way. There's no question about that.
We actually had students who, as like a homework project, went to Canary Wharf and tried to interview people and get them on camera about, do you know that the bank you work for is involved in the slave trade? Don't think they got very far.
So they were doorstepping RBS employers?
Yeah, actually, looking at the database and everything, someone I think locked up to individual properties and asked people, so we actually got a complaint. They got really into it.
Yeah, I'm good for them. But and we've had the same response doing it, kind of not more politely, but more formally. In most cases, it's this. RBS are different. Okay, they do care. They have historically cared about their heritage. And this report, of course, they could have taken it off the internet. Right? Mm. Other banks have absolutely done that. I mean, there were reports available that are no longer available. And Barclays never made their equivalent report available. Barclays is a very complicated story. And again, it tends to get surfaced very quickly in the context of slavery and kind of the legacies today, but it's a very mixed picture. The Barclays were a Quaker family, and one member in the 1790s, more or less the only slave owner we've ever found who did this, freed his enslaved people. He picked them up and put them down in Philadelphia and tried to settle them in the Quaker networks in Philadelphia. Part of their business is entwined in the same way, not necessarily with slave ownership or with the slave trade, but with the West India merchants. Again, that Kate described, they have to build a capital base, very expensive to import sugar and pay the duties, and so they're also tapping into this financial network. And so again, it's an Nathaniel's question, how much and how important are always the questions, and they can only be resolved, I think, in the end, at the level of the individual firm and institution, to say, we think that 10% of the business was slave-related, or we think 20% of the business was slave-related, whatever the number is. Of course, in many cases, it would be 100% for firms that were dedicated to the West Indian merchant business, but most of those firms disappeared. People retired, or they went bust, and again, you should be clear, this is a risky business. For the investor, this is a risky business. High return and high risk. Slave trade, yeah.
I was just wanting to go back to the case of Chicago and what conditions created the pressure for the banks to account for their history.
Well, it was a movement that extended to other cities where there were either majority African-American councils or a significant component reflecting the population. So Detroit, Atlanta, the same thing happened. In California, there was a decision that insurance companies should make disclosures that were similar to this. And again, the point here is not to say, if you have a slave past, we won't do business with you. It's to say, if you have a slave past, tell us and tell everybody else. And in California, it's public, and Chicago.
And it's local government doing it.
This is not a federal law, it's a state thing. This is, let's say, city councils. Mm-hmm. And their lever is, to do business with us, we want you to assure us on a certain number of things. One of the provisions of the legislation is that the firms record the names of the enslaved people whom they find in their records. And again, going back to some of the conversation yesterday about the fragments that exist on enslaved people's lives, but the totemic significance of saying, okay, if there is an enslaved person, we want that to be recorded and treated as a piece of historical reality and evidence and recovered, even if that's the only thing that we know about them was that their name was on the list of people, and we know that name is a name given in captivity, but nevertheless we want to capture those people because they are as much part of the story as the bankers who were financing this. Okay. So as I said, I think economics in the classroom is a tough thing, I understand that. And I think it's not the most difficult thing to teach because of course what Kate was talking about earlier on trumps this by some distance, I think in terms of the challenges to you. But I think my sense is that there are tools that jointly, at least, we can derive out of this process that will help position this in the classroom and do for you what some of the current texts perhaps don't fully achieve. Thank you.
Thank you.
If folk need to just have a quick loo break, there's no break at this point, so we've only got an hour and 10 minutes till lunch, so if you do just need to use the facilities, please do, and we're going to start soon, everybody's seated, we're going to kick off.